Hello, this is Sparks from Radiofax, 6205 and 12255. It's our weekly programme of technical news and features, and in Sparks this week, First National Radio awarded a commercial licence, news of pirate radio in Derry, Veronica goes commercial in Holland, digital audio broadcasting, some news on virtual reality, and also how gullible are you? Our first pirate radio roundup, and of course, your letters. Stay tuned.
Alright. Here's a piece of information we've got from the BBC about medium wave services for local radio. BBC Radio Shropshire has been told to end their medium wave service by December the 23rd. The station itself is hoping to get this date extended till February 1992 so that it will still show in the JICRA figures. So they will be closing the 756 and 1584 kHz outlets. What's going to happen to those two frequencies is 756 kHz will be used for a new service in South Shropshire with an ERP of 630 watts. The 1584 service will be used for North Wales from Mould, and that will be for the next Radio Authority local station. It's also understood that the temporary medium wave frequencies of 603 kHz, 1332 kHz, 1368, 819 kHz and 738 kHz used by several BBC local radio stations on a temporary basis will also close by October 1991. That is the present plan. All these frequencies will in due course be reused for Radio Authority local stations. Whether they actually close this year is yet to be seen.
Interesting for those of us who do still listen to medium wave. It's Sparks from Radio Facts, and here's something about digital still photography.
From Electronics Times, Consumer Watch. You can never find us. We're always in the wrong order, and only one person at a time can look at us. What are we, as Robert Robinson might ask the family? The answer is photographs. This time, though, the family being questioned is not Mr. and Mrs. Quantity Surveyor and their two precocious children, but 1,000 Americans interviewed by Kodak. The consumers were asked what they didn't like about photos, and the opening description sums up their main complaints. The criticisms confirmed Kodak's belief that there is widespread dissatisfaction with paper as a medium for photos. Scott Brownstein, in particular, was firmly of the mind that photos should be stored on CD. As manager of advanced development at Kodak's consumer imaging division, he is the driving force behind Photo CD. Take a film to a developer 12 months from now, and you may be given the option of having your prints digitized onto Kodak's gold-coloured CDs for around £10. Stick the disc into a £300 player and you can view them on your TV, selecting the order and size of the pictures with a remote control. With up to 100 photos on each CD, knowing where to find your snaps is just one advantage, said Brownstein. The interviewees especially liked being able to show photos to several people simultaneously without peering over each other's shoulders. They liked the big bright picture, they like the convenience, and they like the apparent organisation, said Brownstein. But surely a slide projector gives the same advantages, much cheaper. Virtually no one in the US shoots transparencies, Brownstein countered. It's a hassle to set it up and the performance is not as good as negatives. I ventured that technophobia will leave photo CD on the shelf. Garage mechanics said they understand it and want it. We even went back to people and said, look, you really don't want this, do you? But they said, yes, we do. But £300 is too much to pay if you already own a CD player. We were worried that people wouldn't buy a second CD player, but a lot of them want a second one for the den or another room. That wasn't an issue. Brownstein is confident of his arguments. The reason that other electronic cameras failed, he said, was because they didn't give the option of a hard copy. Any film shot on any camera can be put onto a photo CD, and after viewing you can return the disc for prints of the best pictures. The developers are also said to be keen on buying the processing equipment with boots and supersnaps showing particular interest. Washington Smithsonian Institute thinks the system may solve the problem of where to store its 4-meter pictures. Future options will allow a soundtrack to be added or album pages designed on screen for printing out on one piece of paper. And if you zoom in really close, you can play that other favourite Ask the Family game.
Local paper, the Derry Journal, upstaged by Jason Donovan. Here's a report about a raid.
Radio transmitter seized in raid. Closed down pirates threaten legal action. This is by Sean McLaughlin in the Derry Journal. The proprietors of the Northwest-based pirate radio station Riverside 101, who have been off the air in Donegal and Derry since Thursday, have claimed that they will be back on air this morning. The station went off the air following a raid by Gardaí and Department of Communications officials on Wednesday morning. A firm of Derry solicitors confirmed to the Journal yesterday evening that they have received instructions from Riverside to take legal action against the Department of Tourism, Transport and Communications in Dublin because of what they allege was damage done to legal broadcasting equipment during a department operation in the region on Wednesday. Speaking to the Journal yesterday, a spokesperson for Riverside said that the equipment, which they claim was not seized but damaged, was operating on a legal frequency and that the damage caused to the equipment by the Department of Communications officers would have to be paid for. The spokesperson said that despite the setback, Riverside 101 was still broadcasting in the Coleraine and Omagh areas and would definitely be back on air in the northwest region this morning.
claiming that they were a semi-legal radio station, the spokesperson said that they had applied for a license for their transmitters and were waiting for word back from the appropriate authorities. He said, "These people can shout and roar as much as they like, but they really can't do anything about it. They have made a serious mistake damaging legal equipment, and we are going to take them to the cleaners for the damage and inconvenience caused." Meanwhile, Sergeant Jim Moore of Burnfoot Garda, whose men were involved in Wednesday's incident, has said that his men were involved as purely backup to the Department of Communications officers. He said, "Equipment was seized on land at Killie, and it was taken to Burnfoot Garda Station. It was supposed that the equipment was the working parts of the transmitter. Garda officers were involved in the incident as purely backup and were only there to assist and liaise with the department. During the operation, there was a lot of shouting from the northern side of the border from people probably involved with the station." Meanwhile, a spokesman for the Department for Communications in Dublin, Mr. Tom Kennington, last night issued a warning to those who advertise with pirate radio stations and people who made their land available for broadcasting, saying that "we will do everything in our power to close these stations down." He revealed that a number of court cases were pending in the county, and the department was determined that illegal broadcasting would be stamped out in the region through the courts. Mr. Kennington acknowledged the fact that officers from his department had been active in Donegal on Wednesday, and that equipment had been seized. He said, "The department is fully aware of the activities of illegal broadcasting in the county, and that it is against the law. Highland Radio is the only legal radio station operating in the region, and they have been issued with an exclusive license for the matter. We have a commitment to close these illegal radio stations down. They had the opportunity to apply for a license, but either failed to apply or were refused. And for that reason, we will do whatever we can to put these people out of action. We will also continue to stress the fact to advertisers and landowners that it is illegal to advertise for these stations and to offer them their land for broadcasting. Anyone who supplies electricity to the illegal stations will also come under the law, and electricity and telephone lines will be cut off," he stressed. Last month, in a new move in the long-running saga of Donegal's pirate radio stations, the Department of Communications inserted advertisements in local newspapers naming the three stations operating in North Donegal, and warnings of penalties for those involved in the operation of these stations. Also, last December, the department said they would be taking action against pirate stations in the area, and although a number of landowners had been prosecuted for allowing broadcasting equipment on their land, the three stations had not been affected radically. Last December, the Department of Trade and Industry in London said they were preparing to clamp down on all pirate stations operating in Northern Ireland, but Riverside continued to function unaffected up until last week. It is believed that the department had been planning action against the pirates for some time, but were concerned about the stations receiving warnings about the impending visits of inspectors. A spokesperson for the Independent Radio and Television Commission in Dublin has welcomed the action taken by the department in Donegal last week, saying that they had been pressing the department for some time to take action against the pirate stations. The spokesperson said, "We would also like to take this opportunity to reiterate the fact that Highland Radio is the only legal station operating in Donegal, and for that reason it should receive the full support of the general listening public." The station manager at Highland Radio, Mr. Charlie Collins, said that he welcomed any move by the government against the pirates, saying that he felt the stations should have been off the air a long time ago and the department should have acted long before now. Meanwhile, the Minister for Communications, Mr. Seamus Brennan, TD, during his visit to Donegal last week, stated that pirate radio stations and their advertisers throughout the county could expect to feel the full backlash of the authorities. Pointing to recent moves by Gardaí in shutting down illegal stations operating in the region, the minister maintained that pirates were being dealt with very severely by the Department of Communications. That report brought to you there from the front page, occupying about two-thirds of the front page of the Derry Journal.
And the final third of the front page being occupied by Jason Donovan. So, hello to another righty, if that's the correct word. I'm sure it isn't. Bradley Allen in Whitstable in Kent. Now, he's one of our first contributors to our Pirate Radio listings. And so I'll crack on with these. I will read them in full because they're rather interesting if you're new to this hobby and you don't know where to tune to hear the various stations. So forgive me for reading a fairly long list, but some of them I hadn't heard of when I read this. 6205 Radio Delta, 6210 Radio Geronimo, 6225 Britain Radio International, 6235 Radio Zenith International, 6240 Radio Merlin International, 6275 WNKR, 6282 Star Club Radio in Germany and Live Wire Radio in England, 6285 Weekend Music Radio from Scotland, 6290 Radio Orion from Birmingham, 6300 WFRL, and that's Weekend Music Radio, 6315 PFBS West Germany, 6540 Sierra in England, 6550 Free Sound Radio International in England, and 7440 kHz, he lists an unidentified German station. And also, I mentioned Tom Reed last week from Macclesfield, but I didn't do his quick listing, so he mentions a few of those shortwave stations. He also adds 6228 Jolly Roger Radio and 6280 Ozone Radio International. And also around Manchester, there are a few FM pirates, if anyone's around that area. On 101 Meg, you can hear Unity Radio, and on 104.4, IBC Radio. So it's not just in London that the underground pirates are in presence. They're, in fact, all over the country. In anywhere there's an urban conurbation, you will find them, I dare say.
Shortwave radio on the move is now a reality thanks to the Philips Car Stereo model DC777. It's perfect for the mobile shortwave enthusiast. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM, FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful amplifier into a single compact car stereo unit. AM, FM and longwave and shortwave radio with coverage from 3170 to 21910 kHz. The stereo cassette deck is auto-reverse. The whole receiver and tape machine receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination, the DC777, is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £299, including VAT and delivery in the UK, or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. Dispatched the same day by registered and insured post if you pay by bank draft, building society check, access or visa. Call our sales line on 0483 275 997, fax us on 0483 276 477 or post Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG, England. You can also contact us for a copy of the sales brochure. 0483 275 997. The Philips DC777 shortwave in car.
And thanks to a special new deal with Philips, we can now offer the in-car shortwave radio for the amazing price of £239. That's inclusive
available
of post
now
and VAT. £239. It sparks from Radiofax. BT seeks clearance for Radio Link phones by Leon Clifford in Electronics Weekly. British Telecom is pushing to be able to use radio technology direct to handsets, providing limited mobility phone services, as well as wireless communications to farms and other remote sites. Such a move would connect radio phone handsets directly into the BT network and fudge the difference between conventional fixed line, mobile cellular and telepoint service operators. BT is currently lobbying relevant authorities for clearance to use radio links to customers in outlying areas because it's cheaper than laying fixed landlines. DTI officials have indicated they would be sympathetic to radio links into fixed point receivers on customer premises, which would then be connected to conventional plug-in phones. BT wants to take radio links directly into telephone handsets rather than fixed receivers, according to BT Worldwide Networks Division Managing Director Chris Earnshaw. BT is hoping to influence changes in telecommunications regulations that are currently being discussed between operators, DTI officials and industry regulator Oftel following last year's government white paper. At the moment, the proposed regulations will prevent BT from offering radio phone services from its network. We're not convinced it's in customer interests for us not to be allowed to go straight to the telephone handset, said Earnshaw. We would like to see radio used in rural areas, and we don't want to see them using regulations to prevent us from supplying a cost-effective service.
I can show you if you'd like to. Walking down Madison, I swear I never had a gun. No one ever shot, no one wouldn't do it just for fun. Walking down Madison, trying to keep my head screwed on. I was philosophizing some, checking out the nuns. When you get to the corner, don't look at those freaks. Keep your head down low and stay quick on your feet. Oh yeah. The beaming boy from Harlem with the Air Force coat. The ones who died, the ones who tried, the ones that sit and gloat. From an uptown apartment to a night on the A train, it's not that far. From the shots in the penthouse to the rats in the basement, it's not that far. To the bag lady frozen asleep on the church stairs, it's not that far.
Would you like to see some more?
I can show you if you'd like to.
Madison, frozen lights for whom nothing's happening. Hungry children in a mother's dilemma. Dumpster diving to feed a baby endless. And you walk on by like it doesn't affect you. The held out hand that you pay no respect to. Nickels and dimes won't even buy your guilt. Another wine or death burned to death in his throat. It's a cardboard city, newspaper metropolis. This is some kind of cold fall. Keep on top of this. The authorities come, patching up the display. Do they solve the problem? No, they move them away. They're in a vicious circle on the fixed abode. The social won't pay them the money they owe. When you got no money, you can't pay the rent. Hypothermia kills, cause the system is bent.
From an uptown apartment to a night on the A train, it's not that far. From the sharks in the penthouse to the rats in the basement, it's not that far. To the bad lady frozen asleep in the park. I can show you if you'd like to. From an uptown apartment to a night on the A train, it's not that far. From the shops in the penthouse.
From music and media. An almost incomprehensible headline unless you're in the industry. It's showtime. FNR wins INR1 with £1.7 million bid. And this is a report by Hugh Fielder and Paul Easton, all about Britain's first national commercial radio franchise. First National Radio, the Showtime station, FNR, has been awarded the 8-year licence for the UK's first national commercial radio station, with a cash bid of £1.75 million, payable annually and index-linked to inflation. The bid was substantially higher than either UK FM or Classic FM, according to the Radio Authority chairman, Lord Chalfont. FNR plans to be on the air in the early summer of 1992 with its popular entertainment service with personality name presenters. The station is chaired by former British Rail chairman Sir Peter Parker, and the directors include Bob Kennedy, who founded ScreenSport cable and satellite television service and is a former director of several ILR stations, including Capital Radio. The station plans to be on air in the early summer of 1992 with its popular entertainment service. Says Kennedy, "We value the license highly. It's a very important license and a national commercial monopoly on FM. The station will be light and entertaining. We will be doing some speech and interviews, but we will obviously keep to the specifications laid down." FNR's backers include Chiltern Radio, which has the management contract for the station, including programming, operational management, administration, and other facilities. Chilton's Radio's Managing Director, Colin Mason, says it will be a lighter sound than BBC's Radio 2. We wouldn't go into it if we didn't think we could make money. FNR will be broadcast from Chilton's Milton Keynes studios and its own studios in central London. Reaction from the radio industry was generally cautious. Says Trevor Morse at Boyfield, Morse and Letwin, the level of the cash bid seems high, particularly in view of the higher-than-forecast transmission costs and rumours that Showtime's revenue projections for the early years were lower than Classic FM. They may well have problems finding a pricing strategy which avoids the commodity trap. Much of the station's hopes rest on launching into a market that is pulling quickly out of the recession. Giles Squire, Metro FM programme controller, says, I hope they have plenty of Sherpas because they have a few mountains to climb, like how to persuade older listeners who are set in their ways to listen to an FM station, which means many of them will have to buy a new radio. Persuading advertisers that there really is a market for older people and overcoming the restrictive format of the station. Now that restrictive format is laid down in law. At least 75% of airtime in any three consecutive hours must be devoted to music. The remainder may be speech or music. At least 75% of the music in any three consecutive hours must be non-pop, as defined by the Radio Authority. There is no requirement to carry news. And the station is required to start with seven named transmitter sites, serving over 70% of the United Kingdom's population. It will be expected to cover approximately 85% of the population within 2 years. And the frequency this will all be broadcast on is a 2.2 megahertz band, national band plan, between 99.9 and 101.9 FM. That report on INR1, Britain's first national commercial radio station, from Music and Media. And I thought we were Britain's first national independent station, Andy.
Oh, thank you, Trevor. Always modest. Well, the requirement from the Radio Authority to be non-pop is it must be non-rhythmic and non-electrically amplified, as I understand it. It's most peculiar. It's Sparks on Mondays and Tuesdays, our weekly technical programme of news and features from Radio Facts, and this is Grace Jones.
Riding down those city streets.
well. We'd love to hear from you. Write and tell us about yourself, where you live, and what you do, and I promise to give you a mention on Sparks. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And one intrepid person has written in, and as promised, he gets a mention, Neil Oakey from Whitstable in Kent. I must say, I'm very pleased that Radio Fax is back to its old format of technical information interspersed by music. I think there's a big gap in the radio spectrum for a programme of this style, and I wish you all the success in the world in gaining a UK broadcasting licence. Well, why don't you write to your MP and ask him, in no uncertain terms, why there are no shortwave licences available? And when you get your reply, because you will get a reply, you'll probably get a reply from the Home Office, I would have thought. And send it to us, please, Neil, and we'll read out your reply. He also mentions, I know that Andy Bradgate is ex-Caroline. I would be interested to know what stations the other presenters had connections with. Well, Trevor, of course, is Trevor. He's the boss. Radio Fax. My name is Prof Parker. My real name is Andy Burnham. And on Caroline, I was Andy Parker or Joss Stig, even. I can't remember it now. And I'm well known for the one that no one can remember. However, I did do it, and I also did some stuff for Radio HMV in London. So, we shall continue with this.
The impact of digital audio broadcasting on radio in the United Kingdom. The Audio Engineering Society recently organised a meeting on this subject, which was addressed by Mark Thomas, who is Head of Engineering at the Radio Authority. Mark Thomas covered the background organisation of the Radio Authority and then set out to describe some of the aspects of digital audio broadcasting as they might affect manufacturers and listeners in the next few years. Within the United Kingdom, the independent radio sector is under the development of the Radio Authority. As the FM spectrum becomes increasingly congested, it becomes harder for the domestic and mobile listener to experience quality reception. Some 90% of radios used are portables, and people are expressing the desire to have radios with the same ease of use and high functionality which is achieved with, for example, CD and Walkman cassettes. Amongst the advantages of the COFDM type of transmission is the great freedom from multipath distortion, in other words, improved reception quality. The Eureka project, under which the development has taken place, has been widely accepted. Now that the technology is available, it does need to be brought to the marketplace. Initially, digital audio broadcasting was seen as a satellite-sourced signal, in which a ground station would uplink to a satellite for celestial re-radiation. Obtaining a satellite allocation for the 1.5 GHz based channel needed is not without competition nor cost. Proposals for a 2.5 GHz based carrier frequency need to recognise the increase in power and cost by nearly four times. Satellite transmissions thus pose problems, and attention is drawn to terrestrial sources. From the consumer point of view, it is necessary to be able to show consumers what the benefits of digital audio broadcasting may be. The task is to determine a strategy for its implementation. The constraints of mobile reception set some limits and affect the choice of the carrier frequencies. Efforts are being made to use existing terrestrial aerial centres and use Band 2 standard FM band frequencies. The highest terrestrial carrier frequency, which can be used, is around 250 MHz, and so some existing users will have to move. This train of development is progressing, and we can look forward to some interesting developments as ideas for implementation begin to take shape. Questions were asked which recognise that digital audio broadcast transmissions used significant spectral space, and work is still in progress concerning co-channel interference. Indications were that up to 16 channels might fit into a 4 MHz bandwidth block. One next effort of the COFDM transmissions is that for identical blocks, transmission protection ratios can be as low as 0 dB, whilst for different blocks, 10 dB seems to be sufficient. Of course, distance is much more effective a separator than is the case in FM, where 45 dB protection ratios are needed for good reception. There are problems with 1.5 GHz, since it is a major radar frequency and amateur band frequency area. 2.5 GHz is a standard industrial, scientific and medical band and would be preferred by some, although broadcasters would prefer the 1.5 GHz band. For independent radio, digital audio broadcasting is likely to be most usable in built-up areas rather than isolated stations. Satellites offer supra and pan-national coverage, and this kind of source is unlikely to be available until into the next century. Of course, the technical arguments do need to be considered in the light of the intended social role to be played by such services. Digital audio broadcasting does allow greater flexibility in matching spectrums to use, though there is the risk of promoting the supermarket approach, whilst not providing for the corner store broadcaster. That report by Alan Mornington West on an Audio Engineering Society meeting about digital audio broadcasting, a lecture given by Mark Thomas, who is Head of Engineering at the Radio Authority.
6205 and 12255, it's Sparks from Radiofax. And hello to Niels A. Holst from Rønne in Denmark. He's an electronic engineer, and he's 25, the same age as me. Many thanks for your transmission, he writes. He receives us on a Kenwood R600 and a 40-metre long wire. And his comment is, too much talk, let's get some music. Why do we bother? Anyway, this for him is Living Colour.
Yeah. Hey, what do you mean my credit's no good?
In Private Eye, there's a piece by Sally Deeds about mobile telephones. Mobile phones, according to Norman Lamont in his last budget speech, are a menace to society. What the Chancellor might have added was that the binding and exorbitantly expensive contracts that come with them, drawn up by the airtime providers, can be extremely uncivilised too. A case in point is that of Mr. Philip Carr, who in March 1989 bought a car telephone from HL Communications of Croydon on a 12-month contract that required 12 months' notice to terminate, in effect obliging Mr. Carr to pay for the telephone line for 2 years. After 3 months, Mr. Carr realised the car phone was, for him, a rather useless piece of equipment, since he didn't receive enough calls to justify the steep monthly rental of £30. With a somewhat dented ego, he sold it on to a friend, who told the company of the transaction, asking it to draw up a new contract in a new name. 3 months later, the company still having not delivered a new contract, the telephone was stolen and the line cancelled. Mr. Carr found himself responsible under the contract for a non-existent line and a phone, rather like renting out a room in your house that is then burnt down and you expect them to continue paying rent, he said. At the end of 2 years, Mr. Carr and HL Communications met in court. The conditions of the contract, which run to some 45 clauses, with subclauses, are printed in such Lilliputian Bible text that the judge had difficulty deciphering the relevant points. Once deciphered, it appeared that the contract suited one party, HL Communications. Indeed, even the lawyer for the firm admitted in court that the terms of the contract are harsh, but we are seeking strict enforcement of the contract. The judge could only agree, but added that they were the harshest terms he had ever seen, and were almost draconian. But since the law was the law, Mr. Carr had to pay up £466 and costs. In all, he paid £611. Cellnet and Rakel Vodafone have divided up the airways between them, but it is the service providers, the mobile phone retailers, who decide the length of time a contract should run. Some run for as long as 7 years. To avoid falling into the same trap as Mr. Carr, mobile phone users should consider insuring their phones against theft, breakage, etc., with a policy that covers them for the remaining period of their contract. Or they can try to negotiate a buyout of the remaining contract. And they should always read the small print before signing anything. That piece by Sally Deeds in Private Eye.
I'd rather live in his world than live with him in mind.
World is his and hers alone.
He kept dreaming,
dreaming,
ooh, that someday he'd be a star.
A superstar, but he didn't get far.
But he so found out the hard way that dreams don't always come true.
Sparks from Radiofax 6205 and 12255. If you'd like to write to us, it's Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 to Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranleigh, England, GU67BG. Well, some letters in a minute, but first, how gullible are you?
From Skeptical Inquirer, True Believers by Bruce Boer. Anyone who has chuckled at an outrageous headline blazing across a supermarket tabloid can tell you that understanding an idea and believing in that idea do not go hand in hand. Otherwise, checkout stand regulars would accept such proclamations as cavemen looked like Elvis as articles of faith. Think again, shoppers. Inquiring minds not only want to know, they also tend to believe, at least initially, what they read and hear. According to psychologist Daniel T. Gilbert of the University of Texas at Austin, much recent research converges on a single point. People are credulous creatures who find it very easy to believe and very difficult to doubt, Gilbert argues in an article in the March American Psychologist. His contention may spark debate, but it hardly qualifies as unprecedented. More than 2,300 years ago, Aristotle said the ability to doubt is rare, emerging only among cultivated, educated persons. Aristotle's claim has gained support in the past decade from several studies indicating that young children generally accept the statements of adults uncritically, a tendency that often distorts youngsters' eyewitness accounts of crimes. However, current psychological theories of belief formation lean more heavily on the notions of another philosopher, René Descartes. The influential 17th century French thinker maintained that the mind effortlessly and automatically takes in new ideas which remain in limbo until verified or rejected by conscious rational analysis. Descartes' detachment of comprehension from critical assessment, although less well known than his separation of mind from body, continues to influence scientific assumptions about how people think, Gilbert maintains. For instance, computer scientists typically design state-of-the-art systems modeling language acquisition and other mental abilities to ingest information in a neutral form before determining that information's usefulness or destination. But Spinoza, writing shortly after Descartes' death, offered an entirely different perspective on thought. Spinoza argued that to comprehend an idea, a person must simultaneously accept it as true. Conscious analysis, which depending on the idea, may occur almost immediately or with considerable effort, allows the mind to reject what it initially accepted as fact. Spinoza's seemingly preposterous claim finds backing from three experiments reported by Gilbert and his co-workers in the October 1990 Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. The experiments test a basic assumption of Spinoza's theory. If people initially believe both true and false ideas, interruption of the mental evaluation of those ideas should interfere with the ability to reject bogus claims, while true notions would maintain their seal of approval. In the first of those studies, 35 college students learned the meaning of fictitious nouns, which they were told represented Hopi Indian words, by reading definitions on a computer screen, such as a tuirin is a doctor. Immediately, after each definition appeared, the computer displayed the word true or false to indicate whether the statement was correct. On some trials, a tone sounded just after the computer confirmed or denied a statement. Because students had to press a response button when they heard the tone, it momentarily distracted their attention. Interruption by the tone caused a substantial increase in the number of computer-denied propositions that the students later accepted as true on an identification test. On the other hand, interrupted students were not more likely to label a computer-affirmed definition as false. By initially accepting both true and false ideas, the volunteers apparently thought in a Spinozan fashion, Gilbert asserts. Thus, distractions undermined the subsequent thought necessary to scrutinize denied claims but not affirmed ones. Descartes' scheme, in contrast, assumes that interruptions play equal opportunity havoc with the rational evaluation of both affirmed and denied statements. In the second study, 20 students viewed a series of smiling male faces shown on a video monitor. On some trials, the monitor displayed the words true or false before showing a face to signal whether the man expressed genuine or feigned happiness. On other trials, signal words appeared after the student saw a face. Students who were distracted by pressing a button at the sound of a tone just after viewing each face usually misidentified false smiles as genuine, but not vice versa. Even those informed ahead of time that a smile was false often labelled it as genuine if they were subsequently interrupted. In other words, when distractions derailed their train of thought, volunteers who had been given reason to doubt false information, nevertheless, tended to accept that information as true. In the final study, the researchers presented 30 students with descriptive phrases about an imaginary animal called a gluck. Participants then decided whether new propositions about glucks were true or false. During this task, they were occasionally told to read a statement about glucks as quickly as possible without gauging its veracity. Each of these phrases appeared a second time during the test for evaluation as true or false. Students probably accepted quickly read propositions at first rather than treating them neutrally, Gilbert argues. They later reported 1/4 of the speed read false statements as true, whereas they identified nearly all the speed read true statements correctly. We're naive Cartesians, Gilbert contends. We assume beliefs are under conscious control at all times, but beliefs can be created merely by passively accepting information without attempting to analyze it. He points to other lines of research that support his argument. For instance, psycholinguists established nearly 20 years ago that people presented with true and false sentences generally take less time to determine the accuracy of the true statements. One research team wrote that when individuals read assertions, they start with the truth index set to true. Psycholinguistic work also suggests that the comprehension of a denial, say armadillos are not herbivorous, first involves grasping the concept under dispute, armadillos are herbivorous. A Spinozan mind employing this mental tactic should at times believe what has clearly been denied, Gilbert points out. A 1981 study directed by psychologist Daniel M. Wegner of Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, illustrates this paradox. In a finding of particular interest to journalists, students who read propositions like Bob Talbot not linked to mafia reported markedly more negative impressions of the fictitious Talbot than did students who read neutral statements like Bob Talbot celebrates birthday. People also automatically tend to seek out evidence that confirms their beliefs about others. Studies have shown, for example, that volunteers led to believe in the outgoing nature of a young woman later asked her questions concentrating on the extent of her sociability, while neglecting to probe for shy or reticent aspects of her personality. In related work, psychologists studying persuasion and lie detection have observed that people often believe what others tell them without question. Opinions about others, as well as autobiographical claims, often gain acceptance more readily when the listener performs a competing task that diverts attention from the speaker's message. People who sell used cars and vacuum cleaners have long known about the persuasive power of timed interruptions and diversions, Gilbert notes. Many brainwashing and coercion techniques rely on extreme methods to fragment the attention of political prisoners, he adds. Interrogators often keep prisoners awake for days at a time and then browbeat the exhausted captives with an ideological barrage they find difficult to resist. Forced confessions also exert insidious effects. After writing and reciting a captor's message many times over, weary prisoners start to doubt their own opinions. The same principles extend beyond used car lots and dictators' dungeons, warns psychologist John A. Barr of New York University. My hunch is that control over automatic, unconscious influences on judgment and behavior is not usually exercised, says Barr, who co-edited a compilation of research on the subject, Unintended Thoughts, 1989, Guilford Press, New York. It's not that people are lazy. They tend to think these influences don't exist and often don't have the luxury of extended thought about what they hear or read from moment to moment. Moreover, Gilbert argues, just as healthy people immediately believe what they see, doubting their eyes only on rare occasions, so must they initially believe what they read or hear, if only for a fleeting moment. Gilbert and his co-workers have yet to study whether distracted attention increases the likelihood of believing obviously outrageous assertions. Although Spinoza's theory holds that a statement like "Hitler was a woman" meets instant acceptance and almost as quickly goes up in flames as contradictory evidence leaps to mind that prediction proves difficult to study in the laboratory, despite gaps in scientific knowledge about belief formation, the burden of proof has shifted onto Descartes' theory, Gilbert contends. For now, though, a 1984 Gallup poll of a national sample offers a bit of comfort to the much maligned Spinoza, one in five respondents referred to supermarket tabloids as accurate. Who knows? Tabloid believers may regularly suffer from attention meltdown in the checkout line upon hearing their grocery bills.
Burnham, Trevor Brook and Ruth Phillips. You're privileged enough to have all three of us in the studio at once. Quite a rare event, I can tell you. Here's Trevor with a letter.
And just one more letter here, Andy, from Dr. H.G.A. Hughes in Afonwyn, Mould in Clwyd. That's in Wales. And he listens on an FRG 7700 with a 10-foot vertical indoor aerial. And he says, usually a reasonable evening signal on 6205. The news items on Sparks are of considerable interest. The music, not to my elderly taste, I regret. But best wishes. Thank you very much, Dr. Hughes in Wales.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen. Tony Prince in 1966. Other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s. And you'll hear two memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC, Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, the legend lives on.
And don't forget, the in-car shortwave receiver is now available for the low price of £239.
Yes, we at RadioFX have done a special deal with Philips, so £239 now.
No excuse not to remember that one. Virtual reality, come on down, from Audio Media. Virtual reality is moving from the media labs into mainstream entertainment. A new Anglia TV games show will pit contestants against the challenges of a hostile virtual city. Tim Frost looks at the problems of using VR in a popular entertainment format. To say that some TV games shows are unreal might be to confirm a popular, if rather biased, viewpoint. But in the case of a new show in pilot production at Anglia TV, it's nearer the truth than normal. As with many games shows on the independent TV network, Cyberzone is being put together by an independent production house. The company in question is Broadsword, who have already scored a minor hit with the children's game show Nightmare, which places one of the competitors into a video game scenario. The new game goes a step further by placing players in a virtual reality environment created entirely by computers. For those who haven't come across VR yet, the concept is simple. A computer is loaded with a comprehensive map of a physical area, perhaps a room, a house, or an industrial estate. The map contains various levels of detail, so you can zoom down from an aerial view of the estate to road level, then move into an office and look at what's on the desk. This is a virtual world that has many of the attributes of a real world without actually existing. So far, this might sound like nothing more than sophisticated modelling, but the interesting part of VR is in the way that the operator-viewer interacts with it, rather than observing this world from the other side of the video monitor. A clone of the operator is created within the image that moves in unison with the operator's actions. The most sophisticated VR systems, produced by VLP in California, use data gloves with sensors that detect any movement, and a helmet, the iPhone, also with sensors to detect the way which the head is pointing. The iPhone covers the face, and two small monitors like the small LCDs found on handheld portable TVs feed a 3D image to the user. So instead of an operator seeing the room they're actually in, and their own hands, they will instead see the virtual reality room and a computer simulation of their hands. VR is interactive in real time, so that the operator can look or move around and reach out and pick up virtual objects off a virtual table with a virtual hand. Virtual reality sound can also be added through headphones, although this is currently fairly crude video game audio. However, systems that can impose artificial environments on dry recorded sounds are already being tested. These create a binaural effect that can respond to head movements, creating the illusion of getting closer to or further away from a sound source, or moving in at an angle to it. The applications for VR go vastly beyond games into all forms of simulation, as well as into new ways of interfacing with existing software tools. How about, for example, moving computer-generated 3D visuals and animations by putting your hand into the picture and physically moving the object in 3D space? Beats a mouse any day. But this is at the far end of the interface scale. Virtual reality infers a level of interface interactive activity in real time, and the label can be just as validly attached to systems with less all-embracing human interfaces. One of the very few companies producing VR software is Incentive Software, who have a very successful range of video games for home computers. Putting large scenes into small amounts of memory is a skill that MD Ian Andrews and his team have developed over the years through writing for the home computers with their limited speed and memory capacities. It's terrifically positive, he says, that we have grown up with the game side, cramming things into small memory and making it very efficient. Our competitors are building flight simulators which have to use big graphics workstations. With unlimited computer power, you are not efficient because you don't need to be. Having seen the wider implications of VR software, Ian decided to separate the game side and the commercial VR sides of the company, setting up Dimension International to concentrate purely on the business applications of VR. They'll be launching a workstation system, Superscape, using VR to do such things as let potential clients walk through new building developments before they're built. Having worked with Broadsword on a BSB games show, Ian showed his VR software to Broadsword director Tim Childs, who was developing ideas for a follow-up to Nightmare. What he saw in Superscape was a potential solution, but one that required fairly radical rethinking to be both practical for the players in the studio and, more importantly, entertaining for the viewers out there in TV land. As a TV program designer, I try and come up with an application that is commercial, explained Childs. It doesn't matter how intriguing and wonderful VR is, unless we provide an interesting experience for those watching the people playing in VR, we don't have a television show. This is one of the reasons that we went for Ian's system, because it is representational in terms of a city simulator, in which we see the players as animated men and women. Having seen Superscape, I realised that one of the hurdles for a TV programme was resolved. The next thing was to create an interface between the VR and the people, how the players would see and view the VR. We didn't want to use monitors, because Ian and I agreed that no one was going to sit down at home and watch other people play a computer game. It had to be more than that. It had to be an entertainment. We couldn't have a passive event where people were sitting down wiggling a joystick. It has to be a lot more physical than that. The idea of putting the players into some form of VR suit was quickly rejected, on the basis that it would have been almost impossible to make good TV out of people lurching blindly around the set. Another reason not to go for the headset approach is that the most important people from Broadsword's point of view are the millions of viewers at home. Not only would the headset prevent them from seeing facial expressions, enjoyment, pain, or exhaustion, it would also provide the player with an experience that the viewer at home cannot share, which would be very frustrating to viewers. The solution was to introduce two mobility stations, each facing a video wall. Each team has two players, a warrior on the mobility station and a guide who has a video monitor with an aerial view of the play area. The mobility station is something like a walking or running machine, on which the warrior can walk forward or backward, run, stop or kneel. Sensors in the base of the station will relay the actions to an on-screen doppelganger, affectionately called a Borg, or for a female player, a Brenda. The warrior's field of vision is surrounded by the video wall, showing the virtual world as seen through the Borg's eyes. The warrior also has a gun that he or she can draw and shoot, and the left-right turn functions are dealt with manually by control buttons. Childs considered the mobility station had all of the features that he needed for the games. They allow the greatest freedom of movement, and they are relatively simple. It is very dynamic to look at. We had to have something genuinely playable as a game. We can always create something good to look at cosmetically, but unless the players are going to enjoy themselves, they're not going to play it, and then we run out of material to record.
breaking away.
Holland's Veronica goes commercial. Two radio frequencies wanted. A report from Music and Media by Magchiel Bakker. The broadcast bomb has dropped in Holland. Now that Veronica has announced its plans to go commercial, with Tros likely to follow, the Dutch public broadcasting system is in danger of slowly falling apart. The remaining six broadcasters fear that the departure of Veronica and Tros will cost the system some 120 million Dutch guilders, approximately $59 million, in advertising revenue. Veronica says the step is inevitable because the country's current broadcasting system lacks any viability, and in order to keep its identity, it must be allowed to go commercial. According to Veronica spokesperson Stephen Gelder, the organisation set a self-imposed goal of October 1, 1992 to make the transition. However, two conditions need to be met. Adds Gelder, we need one terrestrial TV channel and two radio frequencies, one for music and one for news. Also, cooperating with Tros is necessary. Estimated start-up costs are 200 million Dutch guilders per year, and break-even point is reached after 4 years. But all this assumes we get that terrestrial channel together with Tros. Cable is a bad option for us, he said. Although the Dutch government has only recently allowed commercial broadcasting on cable, Media Minister Hedy Dancona said she would be interested in furnishing one commercial TV channel to be shared by the two broadcasters. The remaining public broadcasters would then share the two other channels. Apart from the strong resistance by the public broadcasters on the Dancona's proposals, the biggest stumbling block will be to find the proper legislation that is in accordance with European standards. That piece about Radio Veronica in Holland and the problems of going commercial from Music and Media.